Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 4th of February. Last week, as you well know, it was reported that Wall Street companies had paid $18.4 billion in bonuses to employees, even though the companies received taxpayer money to save them from going completely under. This is more of the economic news this week. People camped out in Miami for the weekend to apply for some 35 firefighter jobs. Bank of America spending $10 million on Super Bowl parties and sponsorship. Wells Fargo planning casino trips, 12 nights in top-of-the-line hotels. This morning, and it will probably happen during this hour, President Obama will talk about maximum wages, $500,000 for some higher earners, executives whose firms receive government financial rescue funds. And banks and other financial institutions that receive capital infusions but are considered healthy could waive the $500,000 salary cap and the stock restrictions under these rules, but the companies would have to disclose the compensation and submit the pay plan to shareholders for a non-binding vote. We'll be talking about all of this first hour of our program today. There are many Americans who are very upset about the amount of compensation that these executives have been receiving, and the question, I guess, of the hour is, should indeed the government intervene here and put a cap on executive pay, and are there other things that the government needs to do to make sure wealth in this country is more equally distributed, or is that a bad idea? We have two guests with us this hour to talk about the issue, and we'll be welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655. Professor Stephen Balsam is here. He's a professor of accounting at the School of Business and Management at Temple University, and he has actually written a book on executive compensation and Introduction to Executive Compensation, and has also done a great deal of research work on that issue, earnings management and capital markets. Professor Balsam, thank you very much for joining us. It's going to be a rip-roaring conversation, I'm sure, and we thank you for participating.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah. Also joining us is Professor Timothy Pollack, and he is a professor in the Management and Organization Department of the Penn State University Smill School of Business. He also was assistant professor at the University of Maryland and at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His research on the social construction of entrepreneurial market environments, particularly the initial public offerings, the IPO market, and he looks at how social and political factors, reputation, celebrity, social capital, impression management activities, media accounts, and the power of different actors influence IPO firm performance. Professor Pollack, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Let's get an initial reaction to, actually this started probably before her, but Senator Claire McCaskill last week decided to introduce a bill, and evidently the Obama administration thought it was a good idea, trying to cap here. She wanted $400,000 a year for bailout recipient employees, executives. Were you taken by surprise by this, or did you think that this might be coming? Whoever, Professor Pollack, you want to start?
Sure. I wasn't surprised. I mean, I figured something like this would happen if for symbolic reasons, if nothing else. I don't know that legislation would actually make its way through Congress. You know, certainly in the form she presented it. But I think that signaling the people's anger over what's been going on is mostly what she's trying to accomplish with that legislation.
Did it surprise you, Professor Balsam?
It didn't surprise me, and I want to pick up on a point that Professor Pollack just mentioned.
Sure.
A lot of what Congress does, including the TARP conditions on executive compensation, are symbolic in nature. The TARP conditions, they limited executive compensation to $500,000, but they didn't actually limit executive compensation. They limited the tax deductibility of it. So the companies involved in TARP could pay whatever they want. They would just forfeit tax deduction, which, given all the losses they've got, are totally meaningless. So I'm not surprised, to put it that way.
Mm-hmm. It's hard for average Americans to take all of this in when you couple these lavish salaries and trips and airplanes, et cetera, with what we're beginning to see, and that's long lines of people waiting for job fairs, waiting for a minuscule number of jobs, say, in the Miami firefighters force. It's hard for us to put all of this together, Professor Pollack.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I think that, you know, I mean, people, you know, the world that executives live in and have been operating for a long time is very different than the world that, you know, that the average American has had to deal with. And, you know, from their perspective, I mean, it's interesting. One of the things we have, you know, that hasn't been talked about that much, and I'm not being an apologist for the executives, but to some extent, they may see they've already made a lot of sacrifices relative to what they were getting before. So even though they got $18 billion in bonuses, bonuses were cut on average, I think, about 50% from what they were last year. So they're saying, hey, I took a 50% pay cut. It was one way that they may be framing what, you know, what happened. But what they don't understand is, well, you know, that's too bad for you, but you're still making, you know, millions of dollars. You know, a 50% pay cut for me, you know, puts me, you know, in the bread line at, you know, at the food bank.
Mm-hmm. Professor Balsam, how will the president deal with this in terms of legislation? What kind of process would have to go through to limit compensation?
Well, I mean, we can look back to when Bill Clinton actually took office. I mean, one of the things he talked about, Bill Clinton, was limiting executive compensation. Unfortunately, he did not do a very good job of it, perhaps because Congress changed the intent of legislation. And President Obama has to be careful that the laws that are enacted have the intent that he, you know, to reduce compensation. If, in fact, it is his goal.
Same question to you, Professor Pollack.
Could you repeat the question, please?
Yeah. How is it that the president is going to fashion legislation here? What would need to happen in order for this to become a reality?
That's a good question, because one of the issues that nobody's really talked about yet is the fact that a lot of these folks, these executives, typically have individual contracts, especially the senior executives of corporations, that specify their pay. And so these are legally binding agreements. And if you pass this legislation and try to effectively invalidate their contracts if they want to get the TARP money, I could see where there could be lawsuits over the enforcement of the legislation, the contracts. So it's going to be challenging. I know they've already as Professor Balsam mentioned, they've already provided a number of outs, even in what I've seen just, you know, in the media this morning. You know, for example, the cash compensation may be limited to $500,000, but they can pay them as much as they want in stock as long as they don't sell the stock.
Mm-hmm.
So they can still pay them more than $500,000. It's just they won't be able to they won't be able to get their hands on the cash on the money immediately until the TARP money is paid back.
And those companies that are doing just fine, thank you. What happens with those, Professor Balsam? Are they okay? Can they pay whatever they want?
As far as I can tell, in the current proposal, if you don't accept governmental money, there are no restrictions on your executive compensation in the current proposal.
Right. And does that include a lot of the biggies or not?
I'm sorry, what do you mean by biggies?
Does it include a lot of places like Bank of America, et cetera? Are there a lot of banks existing without that kind of government support, bailout money?
Well, Bank of America is getting government support now to,
right,
you know, help its merger with Merrill Lynch. But there are a few banks out there, a few large banks out there that still are operating without governmental support. And it's one thing that, I don't know if Professor Pollack is thinking about it, but I know it's one thing that academic researchers will be looking at in the next few years, which banks elected to get governmental support and which ones didn't. And some of them are probably turning down governmental help because of the restrictions on executive compensation. Now, CEOs, they don't want to limit their pay, and neither would you or I.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting issue too, because on the one, I mean, to what extent does the bank really need the money? If the bank is getting the money because they can get it, but they don't really need it, and then they don't take it because of the compensation restrictions, well, that's probably ends up being a more prudent use of the taxpayers' money. If they do really need the money and they don't go for it because the CEO doesn't want to take a pay cut, and then the bank fails, then that is a real problem, and that actually, you know, I would think could result in you know, personally going after the executives for making that kind of a decision, putting their personal interest ahead of the welfare of the corporation.
Do you worry that there may be banks who have already taken the money who really don't need it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure most banks are struggling, but there's you know, probably a difference between those that would fail without it versus those who, you know, could make use of the cash or could help them shore up their balance sheets, but aren't in danger of failing or falling below, you know, prescribed capital limits if they don't get it.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, on an ethical basis, what are these guys thinking? How can you, when so many, you know, a million people have lost their jobs in this country, people are waiting in line for jobs fairs for days, sometimes camping out. What makes you think that you can get bonuses like you have, that you can get private jets, take your family on lavish vacations, treat your employees to 12 days at top-end hotels? When people are struggling in this country, I just sometimes don't know what planet they're living on.
That is a good analogy. I think one thing that has to be pointed out is that in every piece of legislation up until now, restrictions have been on executive compensation, and they usually refer to the top five executives of the corporation. The $18.4 billion that is being referred to was paid to a much, much broader group of executives. They're all, you know, highly paid individuals, and they're all, you know, high managers in a corporation or in a bank, but they're usually well below the top five in a corporation. And what were they thinking? You know, I've read in the newspaper and the press that they were thinking that they have to pay these bonuses to compete, to retain these employees.
Right.
To which I would say, as you open with your example of the firefighters, there's a lot of people looking for work. The market is not that good for people on Wall Street and banking. So even if you didn't pay them bonuses, or if you pay them a lot smaller bonuses, I'd wonder where they'd be going. I wouldn't worry so much about them taking other jobs.
I completely agree with Professor Balsam on that point. That is something I was thinking about too. It's like when they keep making the arguments, they'll go elsewhere if we don't pay them this. It's like, well, where are they going to go? If all the other banks are laying off people, if there's thousands out of work, and if almost every major financial institution is being bound by the same rules, then it's going to, you know, then there isn't really many places where they can go and get paid more.
Mm-hmm. And you have to wonder how much somebody's going to suffer. Maybe you think they will if you're paid $500,000 a year.
Yeah, expenses rise to meet income oftentimes. So a lot of these folks are carrying big mortgages, mm-hmm. and have a lot of other debts that they have to service. You know, so it's a matter of degree rather than kind. So just like somebody who's struggling, you know, somebody who's making $60,000 a year, who's struggling with their mortgage, somebody who might be making $500,000 a year, but if they miss, you know, a mortgage payment or two, they may be out of their home just the same. It might be a bigger home,
mm-hmm.
but they'll still be in the same boat.
Let's welcome phone calls for our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our lines are crowded right now, but keep the number in mind and you'll be able to get through eventually, I would think. We'll take your calls in just one moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to your many phone calls now at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about executive compensation, and the president is going to be making a statement on this morning, actually, at the White House, wanting to impose a $500,000 pay cap on executives whose firms receive government financial rescue funds. Professor Stephen Balsam is our guest, professor of accounting at Temple University. Professor Timothy Pollack is professor of management and organization at the School of Business at Penn State University. And we start our calls with Judy from Reedstown. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I was also concerned with the lavish spending and perks that some of these companies give to their boards of directors. As a matter of fact, several years ago, I called up one of these stock companies, the stock I own, and offered to serve on their board for cheaper because I had the same training and credentials as one of their members. And they told me, well, we have to pay all this money to attract talented directors. That very company has gone into the drink, and I'm beginning to think that the formula that money gets talent is just not foolproof.
What about board of directors, Professor Balsam?
They are paid very well for what amounts to a part-time job. But they are some of them, not all of them. Some of them are very high-qualified, in-demand individuals. A lot of directors are CEOs or former CEOs of large public corporations. To some extent, you do have to pay to get good people. But then again, a lot of these people could afford to work for free. They're so rich. It's a toss-up, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You want to comment on this, Professor Pollack?
And a number of, to Professor Balsam's point, a number of these really highly qualified people are serving on fewer and fewer boards because the demands on boards of directors have gone up, believe it or not. They are, with the passing of Sarbanes-Oxley a few years ago, they're going to more meetings, they're more involved than they have been in the day-to-day activities of the companies. And since most of these folks are very busy and oftentimes, most of them have full-time jobs in addition to their serving on these boards of directors, they're starting to say no to some of these more challenging and more difficult directorships.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call. What about these banks that have received bailouts sitting on all of this money that's supposed to help stimulate the economy? Do either of you have deep concerns about this? What are they doing with all of that TARP money they've already received? I don't know the answer to that.
I do. I mean, I do have concerns about it because the whole point of giving them the money was to get them to start lending it back out and lending it to each other and to borrowers, individual and corporate borrowers, and to get the economy moving again. And some of them are using it to shore up their balance sheets. Some of them, and this goes to the point of earlier that you asked about, some of them who might not be in as desperate straits, who are still getting the financing, might be using it for some other purposes. But to a large extent, we don't know because the way the TARP was drafted and initially administered by the prior administration, we weren't given a lot of information, and they weren't required to provide a lot of information and accountability. So we really don't know how the money's being used. We just know that it's not being lended back out.
Yeah. But Professor Balsam, how can you loan that kind of money? How can the taxpayers be paying per person thousands of dollars and not have accountability? I don't get that either.
Well, I mean, we should have accountability, but let me just back up and sort of answer your previous question. I would worry about the government enforcing banks to make loans with the money, pushing them into bad loans, pushing them into bad business decisions. I mean, the forecasters are all predicting housing prices will continue to drop. If you're lending money on mortgages, that's a scary thing. Unless you have a big enough down payment that prices drop and the person walks away and you've got more losses. And then 2 years down the line, the government regulators, the people who bailed you out, are going to say, what were you thinking?
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't, perhaps the bankers are not lending money because it's not a good business decision.
What about,
and they burned before.
What about for small businesses?
Again, you have to take each loan, can the lender pay it back? If banks are passing up loans that would make them money, that would get paid back, that is a problem. One thing, we are a capitalistic society, a free market society,
mm-hmm.
and it's not, I'm of the belief that it wouldn't be a good idea to micromanage the banks. I mean, the government should take a large stake in the banks. The government should act as a shareholder, as a large shareholder, and throw its weight around. But it shouldn't get down to the level of micromanaging it, telling banks you should make more loans or you should make these loans. In fact, if you look at some of the things that have been written, some of the problems have come about because government was pushing home ownership and creating mortgages, low down payments, all these programs that when prices went down came back to hurt the economy. It hurt the very people who were supposed to help.
You agree with that, Professor Pollack?
In part. I mean, I agree. I completely agree that the government should not be telling banks which loans to make and who to loan and who to loan money to. But I don't think that's the province of government. I don't think it's appropriate. I don't think they have the, you know, the necessary information to be able to do that. On the other hand, I think there are a lot of businesses out there that would be fine and would be able to pay back their loans, especially small businesses, if they can get the capital, if they can continue to gain access to their lines of credit. And so it becomes, to some extent, a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you say, I'm not going to loan to a small business because I'm worried they're going to fail, and then they fail, and you say, oh, see, I was right, well, if you had loaned them the money, then they may not have failed. I read a story, and actually in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago, about a woman who had a small business. She makes she made pear preserves, and she had $100,000 worth of orders that she couldn't fill because she couldn't get the line of credit to buy the ingredients to make the to make her preserves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's those sorts of situations. So I mean, I agree with Professor Balsam that they need to look at the risk, the riskiness, and the creditworthiness of the potential borrowers. But I'm afraid that whereas before the pendulum had swung so far in one direction where they weren't looking at anything and were saying, lie to me so I can lend you the money because I'm just going to securitize the debt anyway, it swung the other way where they've become so risk averse that they won't even lend money to creditworthy borrowers, and then that just, you know, makes the problem worse. And a lot of the issue here too, and with the interbank lending, is trust. If you don't trust and you don't have confidence that somebody else, that somebody's going to be able to pay you back the loan, mm-hmm. you're not going to lend them the money. And so it's, how do we start to restore trust to the system? And the only way you can restore trust is to take some chances, have those, you know, and have those, and have the, you know, the risk you take be rewarded, which then increases your confidence, and then the system will start at least slowly be able to come back to normal. But since nobody really knows how bad the situation is for many of these banks, the banks don't even want to lend to each other because they don't know, you know, how much bad debt is sitting on, you know, somebody else's balance sheet. They don't even know how much bad debt's really sitting on their own.
Right. Let's go to Kurt from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. A comment first. It's going to be very difficult to get Congress people who themselves either are millionaires or by the time they're shortly out of office become millionaires to do what they would be, what they might consider punitive towards their fellow millionaires. Okay, that being said, I think it's pretty foolish and ineffective to try to pass salary caps and wage caps, so forth, on these multimillionaires. We had a system in place, and it ought to be resurrected. It's very simple, effective, a steeply progressive income tax, set the level at 250, a quarter million, half a million, whatever, and kick in 60%, 70%, 80%, right up to 95% or better marginal tax rates on anything over that, including every imaginable reward or payment, whether it's in liquid or illiquid assets, whether it's based in this country or in a different country, tax it. Put the money back in the system where it belongs.
Thanks very much for your call. Professor Balsam, you want to take that first?
That is an interesting proposal. I mean, it would take us back to, I guess we were before the Kennedy tax cuts. Personally, I'm not in favor of, you know, very high tax rates. I think Ronald Reagan said it best, I guess it was the 1980 debate with Jimmy Carter. And basically, the way he framed it is, do you want the government spending your money or you spending it? High tax rates tend to hurt the middle class probably more than anybody else. Just my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm. But it's our money at this point that we're dealing with, isn't it? This is our money. We have a pretty strong investment, and it's a lot of money per person in this country.
Well, now he was talking in general raising tax rates.
Right.
You're referring, I guess, to the bailout to the
right.
banks. I mean, I agree that it's our money, and I think the government could have and should strike a better deal. I mean, there are some countries that are actually going around nationalizing the banks. That may not be such a bad idea. Or letting them fail. One of the big things, and I don't know if Professor Pollack has noticed this, many of these banks, many of these large corporations that are being bailed out, in addition to having large amounts of current compensation, have large amounts of deferred compensation. If these banks weren't bailed out, if these automakers weren't bailed out, all of their deferred compensation, or a great majority of it, would be lost. So it's one thing to put a cap on current compensation, but by the U.S. government going in there as a shareholder, as a lender of last resort, by allowing these companies to continue in existence, they're perpetuating these huge pension payouts down the line that these executives would lose otherwise. And somehow the government should try and get a piece of that, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about this, Professor Pollack?
I think that high tax rates on every high wage earner, I think there needs to be limits. I agree with Professor Balson to that extent, because I think that there are a lot that it does stimulate and a lot of positive things for our economy. And so thinking about the banker separately from the entrepreneur who starts his company and, you know, with nothing, risks everything to build his business and is then successful should not be punished for that. And there were a lot of, when we had super high tax rates back in the 60s and 70s, there were a lot of problems that were associated with that and with, you know, all the in the complications of the tax code with all the tax shelters and so forth. So I appreciate the caller's point, but I think that to Professor Balsam's point, to the extent that they could start that more clawback provisions start being put into some of these compensation packages in the deal, not with just current bonuses, but also with some of this deferred compensation. So if an executive gets money put into the deferred compensation plan or into another form of pension plan based upon performance that, you know, then subsequently turns into massive losses like we've seen in the last couple of years, then there should be some provision made that the money that they got in the good times, some portion of it at least is given back if the performance that it was based on turns out to be ephemeral.
And what do you think about the word nationalization has come up? What do you think about that in America? It has been done elsewhere, England. Professor Pollack.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think that putting our money into the banks and getting nothing for it is problematic. I mean, I think the most successful bailout, government bailout that I can think of in my lifetime was probably the Chrysler bailout in 1980, and the U.S. government took a big chunk of equity for the cash that they gave Chrysler, and they made money on that loan. Chrysler recovered. The government sold off its equity stake. They got the loan paid back, and they made money on the deal, which I think was good for the taxpayers. I think that taking all the risks and taking all the downside, and then not letting the American taxpayer participate in any upside that occurs, is a huge problem. It's like a negative option, because the way options work is you benefit from the upside gains, but you limit your downside risk. And for us, what we would be doing is exposing ourselves fully to all the downside risk and limiting any sort of upside potential. So I think that if we're going to be giving money to the banks, we should be getting some stake in the company that the government should get rid of as soon as possible, but that that there should be some ownership and some upside potential for the American taxpayer for their investment in these banks.
Thanks for the call, Kurt. Let's go to Dan from White Lake. Hi, Dan. Hello, Dan.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Just a couple of quick points. We used to have this problem licked because we had a situation prior to Ronald Reagan.
And we can barely hear you, Dan.
Hang on a second. I'll tell you. We used to have this problem licked because prior to the 1986 Tax Reform Act, the IRS had provisions where they could decide some portion of your income was unreasonable and tax it at 70%. That went out the window in 1986 with the Tax Reform Act. That was a bad idea because it only hit a few people, and it was too subjective. It would be much better. 2007 was the first year in order to hit the Forbes top 400, you had to make $1 billion. We should note that the median income in this country is under $50,000. But if it was $50,000, a billion is 20,000 times the median. That's immoral, plain and simple. And we should definitely have more tax brackets to eliminate that subjectivity of the old regime. And we should also have a regulation to the effect that any sitting member of Congress is not allowed to accept anything from anybody for any reason whatsoever while a sitting member of Congress, and that will get the money out of the system, and then Congress will run actually for the people. Last year, we had 28% of all the income earned in the country earned by the top 1% of the population. The only other time that much disparity existed in this country was 1928, and we know what happened in 1929.
Thanks very much for your call. Professor Balsam.
I would not object to having a special tax bracket for people earning $1 billion or more. I'd have no problem with that. I think, as a professor of accounting, I can also point out that I think the tax proposal had the tax law practice in 86 a little bit wrong. That rule only applied to closely held corporations, so non-public corporations, where the goal of the IRS and Congress was to avoid them shifting income among themselves and the corporation. As far as I know, never applied to publicly traded corporations. They could put in a tax code provision, an excess tax payment on high level earnings. We already had that with respect to golden parachutes. I forget when it was, and I think it's section 280G of the tax code, where if the severance or golden parachute payment is more than three times the salary and bonus of the individual involved, is a pretty large surtax. One of the problems is the unintended consequences, because the individual receiving that payment was supposed to then pay the taxes. And what has happened many times over is that the company making the payment has agreed to not only pay that individual a large severance or golden parachute, but also agreed to pay the taxes on it. So the shareholders who that provision was ostensibly protecting were penalized multiple times.
Thanks very much for the call, Dan. And, he brought up the word immorality, and I think that there are many Americans who feel this way about all of this, that there is something immoral about a top CEO making that many times the median income in this country. Do you see it another way, Professor Pollack?
I hate to put limits on what anybody, should be able to get paid or earn an absolute dollar amount, just because that there are so many different factors that go into it. But I think that part of what's happening is we're a celebrity culture, and many CEOs have become celebrity CEOs, and that's what we're paying them to be celebrities. And so what we're seeing is some celebrity pay effect. And to Professor Balsam's point, a big part of this does come from the unintended consequences of government regulation. In the 1993 or 1992 SEC revisions, where they limited the tax deductibility of compensation, part of what that did was created greater incentives to use more stock options, and that's why stock option pay has ballooned as a proportion of executive compensation. And with the huge run-ups in the stock market in the 1990s, executive pay ballooned. And whereas most rank-and-file individuals, employees, were still getting paid just a salary or maybe a bonus, were paid essentially in cash, the cash payments did not keep up with the rates that we saw executive compensation going up, both because of the rise in stock price, but also because of the size of the grants that were continually being given to these executives.
Right. And it happens in other parts of the world, too. My family talks baseball all the time, and my husband's a baseball guy. But, I keep arguing with them at the dinner table every night when we talk about what the salaries are for people signing for $48 million, et cetera. I'm thinking, I just wish that somebody would have a little bit more empathy for what's going on in this country right now, for the people who are going to homeless shelters, for the people who don't have any money, for the people who can't find jobs, and come out and make a statement, I don't need $48 million. And everybody kind of laughs at me and says, well, that's their agents. That's the way things work. That's what the market will bear. But it seems to me as though somebody needs to stand up and say, that might be a little too much money. Am I crazy with this?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that there, again, we were talking about symbolism earlier, and in the good times, most people don't begrudge the highly successful, highly paid executives and entrepreneurs and athletes and movie stars and entertainers and so forth. In the down times, they do because their pay doesn't adjust. It seems like the rest of ours. But that also kind of is also part of what stimulated us. Stimulates Americans to strive and aspire. In our country, people do see others having these sorts of success. If you don't have any opportunity to achieve, then why strive? So, mm-hmm. But to your point, I think that it's incumbent on our leaders and those who are so richly rewarded in the good time to make more sacrifice in the bad times. And that's why when I look at corporations, there are some corporations, unfortunately we don't ever hear about them because they're not sexy news, but there are some companies that would, during the bad times, the senior executives share the pain and take as big or bigger pay cuts as their lower level employees and so forth.
Right.
They're more the exception than the rule, and they don't get the coverage that it would be nice that they did, and more companies I think should follow that example.
Right. Well, we'll try and find some and talk with them. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. President Obama has decided to take up Senator Claire McCaskill's suggestion that executive pay, a cap on executives whose firms have received government financial rescue funds, should be at, she said $400,000. He's saying $500,000 today, and we're looking at that this hour and welcoming your calls. It's hard to get through today. A lot of you have strong feelings about this, so just keep trying. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to your phone calls now, and we go to Scott from Waupun. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. This is kind of a tricky subject because, as much as you would like to do something, I think there's a slippery slope there. And once government gets involved saying how much a person can make, the thing that concerned me more than anything else is that this whole thing started with President Obama's statement that there will be a time for profits, but that time is not now. And that's an incredibly frightening statement and an insight into the way he thinks about things. And now him trying to mandate what people can make, I think is a really bad step. I do guess have an issue with people making an exorbitant amount of money. I mean, but we don't complain too much, like you were saying, Kathleen, we don't complain too much about athletes. We don't complain too much about movie stars, but CEOs and executive pay seems to be a hot issue. You can look at Robert Rubin, you can look at Harold Raines, who these guys made millions and ran their organizations into the ground, but I think it's a slippery slope once you get involved in determining if a company is allowed to make profits and how much they can pay somebody.
What about when we bail them out, though, Scott?
I'm sorry?
What about when we're paying for this? You and all the people listening, we've bailed them out here. So we have some say-so, don't we?
In theory, I think it's a good idea to determine how much. But my concern is, like everything in government, once you get involved, once government gets involved, they continue to get involved. Okay, we're gonna limit the companies that we bail to how much executives going to get paid. Now we're going to limit them to how much profit they can make. I mean, it doesn't stop with government. That's the concern there. This is a slippery slope, and government has never been able to show restraint. Once they get involved in something, they really get involved, and it never goes away. It's like taxes. It's like funded programs. Things just never go away when government gets involved in it.
Professor Balsam, what do you think?
Well, I think the caller makes some good points. One thing that I always point out with the Alex Rodriguez's is that somebody voluntarily, signed that contract. Somebody voluntarily agreed to pay him $30 million a year. And that was a person who presumably is looking to make a profit off of Alex Rodriguez. In this situation, and that's the owner of the Yankees, in this situation, the government is effectively becoming the owner, the risk bearer for all these financial institutions. And as the owner of the company, the government, the taxpayers, should have some say in the big decisions. And executive compensation incentive systems is a big decision for a company. So in this particular situation where the companies are asking for government help, the government and the president as head of the government has every right to make demands on it. And if the corporations don't like those demands, they can file for bankruptcy. So in a normal situation, I would not want the government to come in and start making regulations for how much money a person can make or how much profit a company can make. But this is anything but normal times.
Yeah.
And the people involved, talking about the loans that they made, the contracts they engaged in the past few years, they themselves did not exercise prudent business judgment. So to expect them to go forward and do that, they don't have a proven track record. Mm.
Thanks very much for the call, Scott. Let's go to Mark from Ashland next. Hello, Mark.
Hello. I'd just like to make a couple brief comments. I'll take my answer off the air. It's a fascinating conversation to me. One would presume that if you were paying a man a vast amount of money, say 10 times, 100 times more than the fellow actually making the product, that this would be a very intelligent, honest, competent person. Turns out, apparently, that exactly the opposite is true, because, obviously, look where we are. We didn't get where we are through competency, honesty, or intelligence. Any one of those factors would have prevented the pit that we're falling down now. Even a small amount of foresight, even if you thought, well, if I made vast profits now, it's sort of like parasite draining the animal it's on, the animal dies, I die too. It's talk about short-sighted. There's something vastly disproportionately wrong with this equation, and I think we're being told a basic lie that these people are worth 10, 100, 500 times more than the guy making the product. And I just want to close with this comment. We have a choice whether or not to believe that lie. And I'm going to read you a little quote. It's one line long. It was said about 60 years ago by a gentleman that many of us would probably remember, and I'll give you the name at the end of it. The primitive simplicity of their minds renders them more easy prey to a big lie than a small one. For they themselves often tell little lies, but would be ashamed to tell a big one. That was by Mr. Adolf Hitler. And I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
All right, Mark. Thank you. Professor Pollack.
I think that that one of the issues we have with executives is just that we don't. It's hard to see what they do. You know, with Alex Rodriguez, we can see his performance. We know how. We know it's easy to measure his accomplishments with a CEO or most executives. We can't see that. So what we look at is the performance of their companies. And if the performance goes up, we assume they're doing a good job. If the performance goes down, we assume they're doing a bad job. And I agree with the caller that I think there has been a lot of bad judgment exercised here over the last 5-10 years. I think that greed, and as long as the bubble was growing in the mortgage market, and this belief in securitization, and as long as the system the system kept rolling before the house of cards all fell, the people got sucked into that. And I think there's also those who are now who made the right calls. We've seen some folks quoted in the media who predicted the bubble and so forth, who are being seen as the heroes now, were being laughed at 2-3 years ago when they were right. were making these calls. So it takes a lot of courage to say and do the right thing when there's all these pressures and incentives to do otherwise. But the question of what executives are worth, I agree with the caller. I think that executive pay in particular has gotten massively overinflated, especially over the last 20, 30 years. when every company, I've done some studies where we look at the compensation committee statements, why they say they pay what they do, and many companies state that they want to pay their executives in the top 50% of CEO pay to attract and retain the best and brightest and so forth. But we're not like woebegone. Everybody can't be in the top half, and everybody's trying to pay in the top 50 percentile, then that 50 percentile moves, and it moves up, and it moves quickly. And so that's one of the reasons pay has increased.
We go to Brad from Green Bay. Hi, Brad.
Hey, I just wanted to reflect on something a couple callers ago made. With this bailout plan, I mean, you can choose to watch Alex Rodriguez on TV or pay to go see him play. It seems with this bailout, you don't have a choice of how much you're going to be paying back to help reduce all these costs. So I just kind of wanted to have a little disagreement there with that. But my comment really is how, if the government is going to be that involved in any kind of pay scales or anything like that, how in the beginning weren't we able to? We know these people are that the ones that got the bonuses are helping drag these businesses into the ground. If I'm costing my company money, I get fired.
Right. What happened? That's a good point. What happened with that, Professor Balsam?
Well, I mean, not everybody getting a bonus was doing a bad job.
Right.
Take, for example, I'm an accounting professor. A few years ago, we had the Enron debacle, and the auditor for Enron, Arthur Anderson, basically went out of business. And a lot of people lost their jobs, a lot of people that were wholly unrelated to the Enron audit, and that was a form of collective punishment. But it generally is the assumption that if the company does bad, you know, you just won't get a bonus, and we see that throughout most industries. But again, in this situation, most of the people working at these big companies did not have a role in what went on. They didn't make the decisions that led to their lack of liquidity, to their nearly going bankrupt. And they shouldn't be fired because, you know, they just happened to work for the wrong company. Should they be getting rewarded? Should they be getting bonuses when the company is doing so bad they've got to get a handout? That I'd say no on.
And thanks very much for your call, Brad. Rosemary from Bailey's Harbor, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I was calling simply, I'm rather going back to the executives getting their huge bonuses, and what I'm getting is a feeling that perhaps the people in France had last century, a century before, when Marie Antoinette was supposed to have said, let them eat cake, when she was told that the people had no bread. And I think it's that sort of contempt that these people are holding us in now. And I know we can't have that kind of revolution anymore, at least I don't think so, but shouldn't they be a little bit worried, don't you think? An awful lot of people are terribly angry.
Professor Pollack, what do you think? And thanks, Rosemary, for your call.
Yeah, she has an interesting point in that in the past, there's been outrage. Every year there's outrage in the media about executive compensation, and I think the executives to some extent get used to it. That, you know, there'll be some article in Business Week or, you know, one of the other big publications. There'll be radio shows talking about, you know, whoever the highest paid CEOs were that year. But then it goes away and nothing really comes of it. And so they've gotten used to kind of being vilified but not having any consequences. But times are different now, that mm-hmm. people are really fundamentally angry in a way that those who have real power and the ability to affect these executives are now acting on that. And because before they've been more or less insulated from the anger of the teeming masses, but now I think they're really going to start to feel, those who don't pay attention are really going to start to feel that feel that anger. I think we saw that with the executives of the Detroit 3 auto
right.
manufacturers and the what happened between their first and second visits to Washington D.C. So we'll start seeing more of that on Wall Street and elsewhere as well.
So if you're paying attention, it means you do what?
It means you show that you understand how others are feeling, and you make sacrifices and you take actions that show that you recognize what you know that people are angry, that people are frustrated, you know, and then and you show some you show your that you're sorry to some extent for what for what's going on, but then also that you're trying to move forward and trying to fix what was broken. I think a lot of to some of the earlier points, I think that there have been a number of executives that have been removed, perhaps not maybe as many as should have, but then the question also becomes who replaces them.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to have a bench.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we've only scratched the surface here. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. It was a very interesting hour, and thanks to all of our callers. We'll be on the subject again. Our guests, Professor Timothy Pollack, Professor of Management and Organization at Penn State University College of Business, Professor Steve Balsam, who is with the Temple University School of Business, where he is a professor of accounting. And thanks to all of you for being here as well. Rhonda Fanning produced the program. Thank you, Ron. Rhonda, and Rob Schroeder is our on-air producer. Thank you, Rob. We'll return with another hour of conversation, and that's coming up following the news. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.